So this is the tail end of the second lecture on bonds and interest rates. What we've learned so far in the context of fixed income, the world of bonds and interest rates, is that our pricing rule comes in the form of a set of interest rates, most commonly a set of spot rates to use as the discount rates. That set of spot rates can be used to draw a graph, and that graph is known as the yield curve. And what you need to understand is that there is one yield curve for a given set of bonds, all of the same coupon interest. But the spot rates are not the only way to do it. Equally well, we could use discount factors. And you need to know how to go from spot rates to discount factors and back. Spot rates and discount factors are not the only two ways of doing it. You can also work with forward rates, and you need to know the relationship between spot rates and discount factors and spot rates and forward rates. You need to be able to go from one to the other and back without thinking. The relationship between spot rates and forward rates is driven by the principle of absence of arbitrage. Now, you need to understand that forward rates are just another way of presenting the information that's contained in the yield curve. Depending on the circumstances, you either work with spot rates or you work with forward rates. And what we're going to look at in this last part of the second lecture on bonds and interest rates is possible relationships between forward rates and expected future spot rates. Now, you've got to understand that spot rates, those are the big R's, spot rates are known today for sure. We get those spot rates from observing the prices of certain bonds. And I showed you, as part of the last lecture, how you do that. The technique is known as bootstrapping. You identify a set of bonds that are trading in the bond market and for which you believe the prices are correct. You trust those particular bond prices. And you back out of those bond prices the set of spot rates. That procedure, which we walked through, is called bootstrapping. Those spot rates, therefore, are known for sure today because they're based on observable market data, namely today's bond prices. The relationship that we've seen already between the forward rates and the spot rates implies that the forward rates are also known today for sure. If you like, you could work out the forward rates from observing the prices of these so-called calibration bonds, the bonds that you believe are fairly priced. What we're going to be looking in this last part of the second lecture on bonds and interest rates is not at the relationship between the forward rate and the spot rate. We've already dealt with that. We're going to be looking at the possible relationship between the forward rates, which are known today for sure, and the expected future spot rates. So now we're attempting to forecast spot rates out into the future. There's more than one theory for doing this. There's more than one so-called term structure hypothesis. There's at least four I can think of. We're not going to talk about all four. We're just going to talk briefly about two of them. The first one is called the pure expectations hypothesis. And the other one is called the liquidity preference hypothesis. And there's a question in the seminar sheet to give you some practice of using both so that you know what the similarities are and you know what the differences are. So let's start then with the simpler of the two, namely the pure expectations hypothesis. So the little cartoon on the slide has a timeline. So today is time little t. That's where we stand today. That's the point in time at which we can observe the prices of certain bonds that are trading in the bond market, and we're looking ahead. We want to be able to forecast today at time little t, what the spot rate will be at some point in the future. So the time interval between little s and big T, that's the period in the future that we have our attention on, and we want to come up with a forecast today for the spot rate that will apply over that period. Now, the length of this time interval is clearly big T minus little s. So we're looking at forecasting the big T minus little s spot rate. But it's in the future. It's not today's spot rate. It's a spot rate that will apply at point little s in the future. And today, we don't know its value. The pure expectations hypothesis says the best forecast today of that future spot rate is the corresponding forward rate that today we do know for sure. We do know this number. Why do we know this number? Because we know today's spot rates, and we can back out the corresponding forward rate today from knowing today's spot rates. So today we know this number, and now we're using it to forecast a future spot rate. In other words, we're using the forward rates that are known today to forecast what will the yield curve look like at this point, little s, in the future. Why would we be interested in doing that? Well, essentially, anything and everything we do in finance is driven by the desire to make money. So if we can forecast what's going to happen to interest rates, if we can find a way today of forecasting what's going to happen to interest rates before the market gets there, we have the opportunity to make money. We're always looking for some form of arbitrage opportunity. Wait a minute, you say to me. I thought you said that the relationship between forward rates and spot rates was driven by the principle of absence of arbitrage. Absolutely true. That's the relationship between the forward rates today and today's spot rates. I'm not talking about this anymore. I'm talking about using the forward rates today to forecast future spot rates. That's why we're interested in this result, because this gives us some insight into what the yield curve may look like at some point in the future. Suppose then that the yield curve today slopes upwards. So, as I indicate with my right arm, suppose the yield curve has this general shape today. Remember, that graph represents the set of spot rates, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, etc., etc., that we know today. Can we infer anything from that pattern of spot rates today? And the answer is, if we believe the pure expectations hypothesis is true, we can. Why does the yield curve slope upwards today? Well, you know that answer from the last lecture. You know that what must be true today is that the forward rates today must be greater than the corresponding spot rates. I explained to you in the last lecture how the forward rate curve is pulling up the spot rate curve, in other words, the yield curve. So if I see a yield curve that's sloping upwards today, then if I believe in the pure expectations hypothesis, I can go further. The yield curve is sloping upwards today. Why? Because the forward rate curve today lies above the spot rate curve. Wait a minute. The forward rates are going to be my forecasting tool for forecasting future spot rates. Ergo, the future spot rate curve must lie above today's spot rate curve. In other words, future interest rates are expected to increase. If the pure expectations hypothesis is true, and I observe today that the yield curve slopes upwards, I can infer that the bond markets expect interest rates to increase. If the yield curve today slopes downwards, why might the yield curve today slope downwards? Because the forward rate curve today is below the spot rate curve, and if you like, is pulling down the spot rates. Now, wait a minute. The forward rates are my best forecast of future spot rates, so the future spot rate curve will lie below today's spot rate curve. Spot rates are expected to fall. So provided the pure expectations hypothesis is true, I can back out of the shape of the yield curve today something important about market expectations regarding future interest rates. If the yield curve slopes upwards, the market must expect interest rates to increase. If the yield curve slopes downwards, the market must be expecting interest rates to fall. At least, that's true if this hypothesis holds. But what if something else holds instead? What if the liquidity preference hypothesis is true instead? What's the difference now? The difference now is the appearance on the right-hand side of an extra term. What is that extra term? Answer, it's a risk premium. Why isn't it there on the previous slide? Why isn't it there in the pure expectations hypothesis? Because in the pure expectations hypothesis, we believe investors don't need to be incentivized to change from being short-term lenders to long-term lenders. They don't need an additional risk premium to lend their money for the long term rather than the short term. And why is that? Because the pure expectations hypothesis assumes that investors are risk neutral, not risk averse. Whereas the liquidity preference hypothesis assumes that investors who would naturally lend surplus cash for the short term have to be offered an additional incentive to part with their cash for the long term. That additional incentive is an additional premium, an additional rate of return. That's compensation for giving up liquidity. Liquidity is what the financial markets refer to, the ability to take cash and turn it into securities by buying shares or bonds, or going in the opposite direction, cashing in your shares or your bonds. The easier you can do that, the more liquid is the situation, the more liquid is the market. In order to incentivize investors who would normally, naturally lend for the short term, in order to incentivize them to lend for the long term, we have to offer them something extra. And that's what Big L, the so-called liquidity premium, is doing. Because if they lend for the long term, they're giving up some of their liquidity for longer. Well, they want something in return. Do you see now how I cannot infer from an upward sloping yield curve today, I cannot infer unambiguously that the bond markets expect interest rates to rise? If the yield curve is sloping upwards today, that means that today the forward rate curve lies above the yield curve. The forward rate curve lies above the spot curve, in other words. But now there are two reasons why that might be true. It could be, as in the case of the pure expectations hypothesis, that the market expects interest rates to rise. But it could be instead the reason that the forward rate curve sits above today's spot rate curve could be because of that liquidity premium. I can no longer infer from an upward sloping yield curve today that the bond markets expect interest rates to increase. It could be that the yield curve is sloping upwards today because there's a positive liquidity premium built into interest rates as compensation for naturally short-term lenders to part long-term with their money. What if the yield curve today is sloping downwards? Then I can say something. If the yield curve is sloping downwards, and I believe in the liquidity preference hypothesis, I can infer that the bond markets expect interest rates to decrease. Why? Because there are two effects at play now, but the liquidity premium is always positive. The liquidity premium is tending to push up the forward rate curve. If I observe that the yield curve, the spot rate curve, is now downward sloping, can you come back later? Okay. Now, if I observe that the spot rate curve is downward sloping, that must be because the market expects interest rates to fall. The liquidity premium, because it's always positive, would be inclined to push up forward rates. So, let me summarise. If we believe that the pure expectations hypothesis is true, then an upward sloping yield curve today implies that the bond markets expect interest rates to increase as we go forward in time. If the yield curve slopes downwards today, and we believe in the pure expectations hypothesis, the bond markets must expect interest rates to fall. However, if we believe the liquidity preference hypothesis holds, we cannot infer unambiguously from an upward sloping yield curve today that the bond markets expect interest rates to increase. The yield curve could be shaped that way because of the positive liquidity premium. However, if the yield curve slopes downwards today, there's no argument. We can infer that the market expects interest rates to fall. So what I want you to understand is we can back out of the shape of a yield curve important information about what the market expects or doesn't expect interest rates to do. Just bear that in mind. There's a seminar question that will give you the opportunity to practice using one or other of these theories. So the last slide then from the catch-up part of the lecture links nominal interest rates with real interest rates. This is something I have steadfastly avoided mentioning. In other words, up to now in this module, I have said nothing about the effects of inflation. And occasionally one or two of you have asked me about inflation, so now I get to mop up. I can quote interest rates on a nominal basis or on a real basis. Real is another way of saying adjusted for inflation. When you look at financial market data, in particular, when you look at the prices of bonds in the bond markets, or equivalently, you look at the yields to maturity on those bonds, the information that's being quoted to you is being quoted in a nominal form. So those quoted interest rates are nominal interest rates. Nominal has to do with the amount of money in your pocket today. Nominal has to do with the value that's written on a piece of paper that represents a bond. What nominal doesn't do for you today, or indeed what nominal doesn't do for you in general, is tell you what can you do with that money. In other words, what nominal is missing is the notion of purchasing power. And that's what the corresponding real values are doing. Real values are adjusting nominal values for inflation. Real values are telling us about purchasing power. When we look at a cash flow, now that could be the coupon interest that a bond pays at regular intervals. That could be the face value that the bond returns at the end of its life. Those numbers are quoted in nominal terms. But if inflation is important, what you can do at various points in the future with those nominal cash flows is going to vary. Inflation is going to eat away at your purchasing power. So knowing the nominal values of those cash flows is not that helpful. The real value of the cash flow, on the other hand, that's the nominal value adjusted for inflation, that will tell you what can you actually buy with that cash flow at such and such a point in the future. So what really matters, it's a bad pun, is your purchasing power. And just as we can measure cash flows in nominal or real terms, so we can measure interest rates in nominal or real terms. The nominal interest rate is measuring how quickly, how fast, is the nominal cash flow increasing. The real interest rate is measuring how fast is the purchasing power increasing. Let's have a look at a simple example that I think will help. Excuse the hand-drawn slide. There we go. So in this first little cartoon, the following is happening. I'm at time zero, and I'm looking ahead 1 year. I've got £100 in my pocket, and my favourite good is a bar of chocolate, and that bar of chocolate costs £1. That bar of chocolate costs £1 today, and I've got £100 in my pocket, and if I'm so inclined, I could buy 100 bars of chocolate with that £100. That's a measure of my purchasing power today. What about a year from now? What can I do in terms of buying bars of chocolate with the same £100? Well, if there's inflation, if the price of a bar of chocolate increases, let's say by 3%, so a year from today, that same bar of chocolate costs £1.3, I can no longer buy 100 bars of chocolate. I can buy roughly 97 bars of chocolate with the same £100. My purchasing power has dropped. Why has my purchasing power dropped? Because it's being eroded by the inflation rate of 3%. Roughly speaking, the reason I can buy 97 bars of chocolate rather than 100 is inflation is 3%. So that's comparing the nominal and the real cash flows. The real cash flow is saying something about what I can actually do with that money. What about interest rates? How do they vary? Okay. Let's suppose I decide not to buy the chocolate today. I'm on a diet. Probably need to be. Let's suppose I put the £100 in a bank account for 1 year. I'm on a strict diet. No chocolate for a year. Let's suppose that that bank account pays me 5%. So a year from now, my nominal £100 will be a nominal £105. Why? Because the nominal rate of interest is 5%. My nominal sum of money has increased from £100 to £105. I really want to buy bars of chocolate. Today, I could have bought 100 bars of chocolate because the bar of chocolate costs £1. We've still got inflation of 3%, so a year from now, my bar of chocolate will cost me £1.3. But I've got £105 sitting in the bank. I could spend all of that £105 a year from now on bars of chocolate if I'm so inclined. I can buy approximately 102 chocolate bars a year from now. My purchasing power has increased. The rate at which my nominal cash flow has increased is 5%. That's the interest rate, the nominal interest rate the bank account pays on my deposit. The rate at which my purchasing power has increased is approximately 2%. The difference between 5% and 3%. So what's inflation really doing? Inflation is slowing down the rate at which my purchasing power increases. If there were no inflation in the story, today I could buy 100 bars of chocolate, and a year from now I could have bought 105 bars of chocolate. My purchasing power would have increased by 5%. Because there's actually inflation of 3%, my purchasing power still increases, but the rate of increase is slowed down approximately to 2%. The nominal rate of increase is 5%. That's what I'm calling big R. The real or inflation-adjusted rate of increase, that's what I'm calling little r, is approximately 2%. And that's the relationship between the nominal rate of interest and the real rate of interest. And the only other point I need you to take on board is what links them, little I, is the rate of expected inflation. We're looking into the future. Inflation rate may change. There is inflation risk in the story, so we have to use the expected inflation rate. You might find it more useful to rewrite that equation like so, because that then, I think, signals more clearly that what expected inflation is actually doing is arresting, it's slowing down the rate of growth. You need to know the relationship between nominal rate of interest, real rate of interest, and the expected rate of inflation. I could ask you typically a multiple choice question about that. And that basically is what you need to know about bonds and interest rates.